Welcome to the podcast dedicated to making you a faster cyclist, the Ask a Cycling Coach podcast presented by Trainer Road. Today, we're going to talk about organic foods and the huge debate if whether us athletes should be eating organic foods and doing it. We're also going to talk about food labels, meal suggestions, and we're talking about those topics because we have Alex Larson from Alex Larson Nutrition with us. Good to have you back on, Alex. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me back.
Yeah, we've got a few questions that were earmarked for you too. They're great ones. But if you're watching this right now, give it a thumbs up on YouTube. Let's get right into the first question. It comes from Freya. Freya says, hi coaches, looking at costs, it's almost a 20% increase in my grocery bill when I buy organic fruits, vegetables, eggs, and meat. For our household of two adults and three young kids, that adds up to almost $160 per month. With all the debate around the benefits of organic food, mostly seems like misinterpretation of research or bad research. Am I correct? What portion of an athlete's diet should be organic? And what do you have in, or and do you have any ingredients to prioritize and others to deprioritize in order to save some of that money? That's a good, it's a good chunk, $160 a month. That'd be like a really expensive subscription.
Almost a year of Trainer Road.
I know, right? It's crazy. Yeah. $189 a year for Trainer Road. And you could, boom, get that in darn near just 1 month of organic stuff. So, Alex, what do you say to your athletes? Because I'm sure they ask you this sort of question.
And this can be such a controversial topic. And I know people can have really strong views on either side of the debate here. And so hopefully we don't make people too angry in this discussion.
No. Put it in the comments.
Yeah.
Put it in the comments.
The algorithm wants it.
Yeah. So, and I will just say that I don't personally eat organic. And so I want people to make an informed decision because truly I respect whatever people choose to purchase. But if it sounds like I have a little bit of a bias towards like conventionally grown food, it's just because I personally don't like seek out organic food in my life and feeding, you know, my family. So the research has found that there's no nutritional difference between organic and conventionally grown food. I know some people talk about how there is a taste difference oftentimes, and so that might be a decision factor for them in terms of what they choose.
Alex, yeah. Sorry. What do you mean by there's no nutritional difference?
Yeah. So they have looked at various foods in terms of their nutritional value in organic versus conventionally grown, and there is like no significant difference in the nutritional value of them. Looking at like produce or dairy or, you know, like those differences. You might see some differences just slightly in like meats, for example, like the organic grass-fed beef, for example. They talk about how they have, you know, a higher percentage of like omega-3 fatty acids in there. Well, what's interesting is that like beef itself isn't very high in omega-3s, so that like 150% increase is like not even like a lot of omega-3s.
Not worth it.
Yeah. So I'm like, if you're looking for omega-3s, like eat some salmon. You know, look for sources that are going to be, you know, very rich sources of that nutrient.
Sorry for interrupting.
No, that's all right.
That's just a really, that's like such a key point because like, let's say I'm incentivized to say that one thing is better than another. I find that 150% increase thing, boom, I'm going to run with that.
Yeah.
Right. And like, and, but in reality, in terms of what that means for your body, in terms of the benefits that it can get from it, it's minuscule.
Yeah.
And that's,
I mean, if you're to compare like the organic grass-fed beef omega-3 content to salmon, like salmon's going to blow it out of the water. You know what I mean? So it's like, you have to come from that practical perspective as well.
It's like pickleball is the fastest growing sport in America. But like, do people really want to, people really play pickleball? Probably not. We're not gonna
play pickleball. That's a hotter topic than this right there.
The nutritional value that I just can't look cool playing pickleball. I'm sorry. Like, I see it.
It's impossible. I always feel like it's tennis with bumpers when I play it. You know what I mean? It's like, tennis on easy mode or something. It's like,
It is tennis on easy mode. Okay. Yeah. So nutritional value, you mean that like strawberries, organic wouldn't have more vitamin C than non. Because if that were the case where like all the nutrients, vitamin C, vitamin E, B12, all that was higher in organic foods, I think we would probably run to the organic foods, but it's not the case.
Yeah. I mean, the difference between them is going to be like, it's not a significant difference. Like, that's the thing. Like, and especially to justify the cost. You know what I mean? Like, that's a factor. And then looking at, so, and in full disclosure, I did in a previous job work in the agricultural community. And so I have spent quite a bit of time out on farms. I've toured organic farms. I've toured conventional farms. I've talked with a lot of farmers. So I do come from I do have a fairly decent knowledge, but I do encourage people to like talk with farmers and get like an understanding of how is their food grown if they do have questions about that as well. Because I think it comes down just to making a very informed decision. And because there's so much controversial misinformation out there, sometimes just going to the source and learning about how your food is grown can be really very insightful for people too.
So I think what people are worried about are pesticides. And if I eat the pesticides that have been sprayed on my mostly fruit, I will then develop cancer, because there's been like people who work in the fields who get sprayed with these pesticides directly have developed cancer, right? And there's been suits on that. And I think that's, in general, I think that's the major concern. And then there's other people with like with dairy and stuff, with hormones and stuff, with concerns. But what do you have to say on that? Because I think people might connect the two, or there might be not a connection.
Yeah.
It's so also hard to tease
the
out.
The interesting factor about like organically grown foods is they still do apply pesticides and herbicides. It just has to come from a natural source. And just because it comes from a natural source doesn't mean that it's necessarily like non-toxic. You know what I mean? Like there's plenty there's plenty of things out there that are natural that are toxic to us. So you have to keep that in mind as well. And when I've talked with farmers, I've talked with conventional farmers, they're like, you know, we've talked with organic farmers, they have to actually apply a lot more frequently those natural occurring pesticides because they aren't as effective as some of the more like synthetically created pesticides, where they can just apply it once and it's going to be very effective and they have to use less of it. So it's an interesting debate in like which is better. You know, my biggest fear is that someone is going to not purchase fruits and vegetables because they're afraid that conventionally grown foods are unsafe and they can't afford organic foods. That to me truly is my biggest fear with this whole conversation. And I want people to understand that conventionally grown food is very safe to eat and that they can confidently purchase that and know that it's important for their family. The one thing that they can do, and you can do this with organic or conventional, is just make sure you wash your produce, because you're going to remove any residue on there, dirt, like germs on there. It's going to significantly cut back on all of that on your fresh produce.
Nice. Can I send people the two studies that kind of summarize a lot of what Alex is talking about here? So then, and I'll link these down below for people. First is by Mesnage and colleagues. This one is from 2020. And it says, limitations in the evidential basis supporting health benefits from a decreased exposure to pesticides through organic food consumption. And effectively, what this one looks at is, like you said, Alex, this one is very like, there's a lot of different reasons. A person might purchase organic because it's part of their motive to be healthy. And it's in, if they think that they're buying something, or if they think that they're buying something healthier, they'll be more motivated to buy it and to stick to whatever, changes in lifestyle and nutrition they have. The other side of it is people are concerned about the environmental impact of farming in situations where it's organic or non-organic. And then there's the other side of things, the pesticides, and then the other side, the nutrient value of the foods. And this one specifically, this study is interesting because what it looks at is the pesticide side of things and how through the overall consensus with the existing evidence right now is that it's really hard to prove the fact that pesticides are causing any sort of damaging health concerns when it's consumed through produce like this. They have a hard time proving that. That doesn't mean that it does not happen. It's just, if we're to look at the body of evidence, that's what is indicated currently. So I think that that's a good, and this is more of like a review, and it's pretty easy to read. So it could be a really good one to read on that topic. There's another, this one just came out. So in fact, I don't know if it's pre-published or something, but this one has the date of 2024 on April 15th. So this is future, but not future when you guys are getting it. I'm not sure how that works. This is published in a journal that's just like large scale. It's called Hellion. It's not like a specific journal that has a specific beat that has like a really high criteria. It's known for just being normal journals. So take that for what it is. But this was by Olivera Faro and colleagues. This was this year. This says, are organics more nutritious than conventional foods? A comprehensive systematic review. This one is very large in terms of the review that exists there. And effectively, what they found is that in 29% of the comparisons, there were significant differences between organic and conventional foods. Now, the key thing, like you said, Alex, is it depends if you're studying something, looking into something like beef, or you're looking into something like any sort of fruit or vegetable, and in terms of what they're measuring, because again, that significant difference in omega-3 fatty acids could exist between beef that's organic and non-organic. However, is that significant to health? That's a separate question. This is just looking at the nutritional value, but that's only 29%. Then in roughly the same amount, it found that there were like, it was too hard to be able to tell from the evidence because of whether it was poor reporting or inconsistencies that confounded findings. And then in the majority of cases, 42%, there was no significant difference between organic and conventional foods. So that's a really good one because you can look through that and get a good idea of, again, the broader picture of what's going on here. Because this is the hard part. Like if you grow a carrot in your backyard, in your garden, versus going and buying a carrot somewhere else. Yes, you can really like understand the process of how that carrot came to be in your backyard. But in terms of us understanding, like you said, Alex, you know, contacting a farmer, doing that sort of thing, it could be really tough and impossible for you to do that with the food that you buy at the store. So it's really good to get kind of a broader picture. So I'll link to those two studies down below. Offer everybody listening.
Yeah, if you've done any gardening and the amount of labor that goes into it, and then when you have a bug come and like destroy your entire crop, like it is so frustrating. Oh, yeah. And I can't even imagine like having it be my livelihood. So I get it from that perspective. And there also is a website. It's called safefruitsandveggies.com. From the Alliance of Food and Farming. So they're a nonprofit that represents both organic and conventional farmers of fruits and veggies. And you can actually use their little pesticide calculator. And like if I go in here and like put in for like a female that's eating apple, like I say apples here, let's see if it loads for me, like a woman, I pick apples, I would have to consume 850 servings of apple in one day without any effect, even if the apple has the highest pesticide residue recorded for apples by the USDA. So that's a lot of apples.
That's a cool website.
So you have to think of like the dose makes the poison. And and so like for those farmers that are out there being exposed to it being sprayed on it, they're having a much higher dose than someone that's going to have a very tiny small amount of residue that's going to be on their produce at home.
Especially if you wash it too. And I know my girlfriend used to live in Tulum, and they wash all their fruit, like they sit it in like a thing of water and they put a package in it. I think some people bleach their food too, kind of thing.
I don't know if I would use bleach. And from what they've said is just running water is just as effective as even purchasing like the fruit and veggie washes. So, I mean,
this is why.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is because they can't trust the water there to be washed. Oh, yeah, so they have to like disinfect the water as it happens. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's what we did.
If you have issues with your water,
that's
a whole nother, you know, ball game. Yeah. But
it was just like a drop or two of bleach in a big bowl of water. And that's like all you needed to then wash them. You know, it wasn't like you were putting, and once again, maybe that's not recommended for everybody, but I have done that.
Yeah.
When I first started training around, I was really into gardening, very merit person to do. And I had like insects come in, and I killed all the crop. I just sprayed the heck out of them because they're so frustrating. I couldn't get them to go. So I sprayed just the worst pesticides I could find and just didn't end up eating any of the vegetables, but they died. They all died. Which is the important part. don't mess with me. So this is the way that I think about it is, so you think of something like smoking, the signal to like noise ratio, really high signal where we can see if people smoke, they get these cancer, higher chances of lung cancer, right? Or cancer of the throat, mouth. And that's very easy for us to see, like to make studies and see that there's a huge increase in it. Where with organic foods, we can't really tease that out. And it is harder with things you eat and stuff, but there's a lot of people who only do organic. And I think there's studies that have looked at it. What we do know though, is that if you eat more like fruits and vegetables, you live longer. That does reduce cancer, right? And if it's for the same price, you always get more regularly farmed food than organic, right? So if price is an issue and you're buying less, you're eating less, to Alex's point too, or eating none, like, we know your outcome is going to be better eating fruits and vegetables that are conventionally grown than no fruits or vegetables. And there is an extent, there's a limit, but there is an extent of eating more is going to be better too. So if price is an issue, you can do that. And then you can do, I mean, if money isn't an issue and that $167 is not an issue to you, you can go organic. But I think what Alex said too, that doesn't necessarily mean it's safer. And just the big point, I think, Alex, is just wash all your food if you're, like, in general, not even just concerned.
Yeah, like, wash your produce, cook it safely, like, eat fruits and vegetables. If you can afford organic and it fits into your budget, great. If not, you can feel confident that the conventionally grown is going to be safe and you can feel good eating that. You know, like, I come from a lot of different perspectives on this topic, but, like, accessibility is another thing. And, like, how lucky are we that we have the option to buy either or? Mm-hmm. You know, where some people access to food is a huge barrier for them. And so sometimes I just sit there and say, I'm so lucky that I have lots of options when it comes to, you know, shopping and what I can choose.
Mm-hmm. Can I go over, like, what is required for something to be labeled organic? Yeah. I feel like that's an important thing too for people to understand. So organic farming, and I'm going to read some of this off here. This is from, like, the FDA and stuff. So organic farming prohibits the use of genetically modified organisms, ionizing radiation and sewage sludge in the production of organic food. And then also to be sold, label, or represent a product as organic, farms and businesses must be certified by the USDA accredited certifying agent. The certification involves annual on-site inspections, a review of the operations, organic system plan, and testing of the soil and water to ensure that prohibitive substances are not being used. Now, there's practical applications of this. Organic crops. For crops to be considered organic, they must be grown on land that has been free from prohibited substances like synthetic fertilizers and pesticides for at least 3 years before the harvest of the organic crop. Farmers are also required to use organic seeds and other planting materials when available. For organic livestock, animals raised for organic meat, poultry, eggs, and dairy products must be given organic feed and allowed access to the outdoors. They must be raised in living conditions accommodating their natural behaviors, like grazing on a pasture, and they are not allowed to be given antibiotics, growth hormones, or any animal byproducts. And then this is a really interesting one here. Organic multi-ingredient foods. Products labeled as organic that contain multiple ingredients must have at least 95% of their ingredients by weight or fluid volume, excluding water and salt, meeting organic standards. These products can be labeled as, quote, organic and display the USDA organic seal. And then prohibited practices and substances, the use of genetically modified organisms, like I said, and everything else there. So that's a lot of hoops to jump through for a farmer, and that makes sense why it costs so much more for you to get what you have.
You know
there.
What's interesting about the marketing of food? Like, if you buy a package of chicken and it says, like, no growth hormones used, they're actually not used in any poultry at all. Like, it's just, it's like the law with farmers is they're not able to use that. So it's like, no matter what package of chicken you buy here in the U.S., like, it's not going to have hormones, you know, used when they raise that chicken. Yeah. So it's just kind of funny how that marketing can think, like, oh, well, then I'm going to choose this one, where it's like, across the board, you're not going to have hormones.
I would put on mine cyanide free.
Yeah.
Like, because if you look at two chicken in the thing, there's one that's cyanide free and one not. Like, now cyanide free. Yeah. I think the real danger, because this is so tough, because we could have a podcast 5 years from now, we might find something completely out different, right? We just want to all acknowledge that the science could change. But the one risk we do know is for sure is salmonella, especially on leafy root vegetables, that there's outbreaks and people get so sick. And I think sometimes children die and old people. And that's can be
even healthy people
prevented by
healthy people. Yeah. Like, they'll go into renal failure, you know, with that. I mean, those things are scary. It's very scary.
And that's why they take it all off the shelves, right? You go into the grocery store and a whole region will not have any iceberg lettuce for a while. And the way to make sure you don't get that is to wash your food, which is probably good in either case.
That's why they pasteurize milk. You'll see even, like, juice, they'll pasteurize that. I mean, they're doing that for a reason, to keep food safe.
Yeah.
Yeah. Should we talk about GMOs and raw milk now?
please don't drink your raw milk. And again, don't hate at me in the comments here, but it's like playing Russian roulette with your life. Unless you live on that farm and you are used to all of those germs. But even a lot of the dairy farmers that I've talked with, they don't even drink their own, raw milk most of the time. A lot of them, they say they just go to the store and buy it.
Yeah. This is taking a step back and looking at this whole thing, it's definitely an individual choice. You can and adjust things as you need, but it doesn't, as far as what the research seems to show us and what Alex from an actual dietitian's perspective and everything else here, it isn't something that she advises her athletes on. So that's the context that we want to keep this in, that they need to eat organic or something like that. Alex doesn't advise that for her athletes. So keeping all this in context is what we're saying here. I know I like personally, I don't know about you guys, but organic bananas, they seem to like they go bad like within like a day after getting them. They don't taste as good. So I get non-organic bananas. But then there are other things that I do get organic with. It's kind of like I have just like a mixed bag of all these things, but it isn't an important variable. Yeah. So
I mean, going back to Freya's question, there doesn't need to be a portion of your diet that's organic. And there's not any ingredient specifically that I would prioritize or deprioritize over others. Just buy what you can afford and try and get as much fruits and veggies in for you and your family, and especially those young kids. It's really good to expose them to a lot of variety at a young age, because they tend to not be as picky later on in life.
Yeah, for sure. Is there, can we go over one more thing? Washing your greens, because that's a really common thing that a lot of people struggle with in terms of they, not getting enough greens and also like getting sick, right? Like it happens all the time. We talked about like generally washing vegetables, but Nate, how do you wash your greens? Like just the process of what you go through when you get your greens and you wash them.
I probably don't do it very well. So the spinach that's in the sealed box, it says like quadruple washed. I just trust that it's okay. Cause when I wash actual greens, they like go gross. And then berries and stuff, I like run it under the water for maybe like 20, 30 seconds. And then I kind of shake it out so the water comes out, and you place it on a paper towel in the, this is the key, in the refrigerator. So it kind of, the paper towel sucks some of that moisture out, because if you leave the moisture on, it's much more likely for your fruit to like rot and get moldy. You can change that paper towel out or something. And that's the strategy that works well for me.
Cool. Alex, do you have anything to add to that?
I actually bought some containers that have like this little like plastic piece on the bottom to kind of collect the water, but keep like the bottom layer of fruit dry.
What are they called?
Oh, that's cool. I'll send you. We'll have a link in the show notes. I'll send you a link.
Sounds good. Good call.
I'll start Googling. That's a good
idea. Awesome. Cool. Okay. This next question is, it's kind of the same beat. It's from Jalex or from Jalex. I blame that. It's probably like seven kids are named that in my children's class right now. Jake says, could you do a food label tutorial? As an example, not everything listed under carbs is mentioned as a sugar versus dietary fiber, maybe some gotcha things to look for, et cetera. Cheers. This would be like, Alex, this is a really good this is a really good thing to cover, because this is something that all of us can do whenever we look at any item at the store. But it is hard to figure out what's important and what isn't important.
Yeah. So, all right. Well, so let's talk through, and this is the U.S. Nutrition Facts label here that we're looking at. And so the first thing I always look for is the serving size, because that's going to give you, and that's not saying what your portion size should be. It's just giving us a unit of measure in terms of like how much nutrition is in that amount. So whether it's, a cup, or you'll even see in parentheses how many grams it is. So looking at that serving size first to give you a context of like how much the amount of it. And then it might also say how many servings per container. So if you're going to eat the whole container, then you're going to have to multiply, potentially everything there on the label. And then you're going to see
like Nilla wafers, those little, I can't have those in our home. Like if those things are just like delicious and so snackable. And then you look at it and it's like 72 servings per box. And you're like, what? It's like a serving is like two small cookies. It's like, no. Oh my gosh. Yeah. It's crazy.
Yes. Yeah, so, I mean, just keep, note that as reference when you're looking at the serving size and then how many servings per container. And then you'll see obviously the calories. So that's going to be how much calories per serving are on there. And then, looking at the next line down will be your total fat. And so you'll notice that total fat is bolded, and then you might see saturated fat or trans fat below there. You might even see like a monounsaturated fat or polyunsaturated fat. Those are going to be unbolded. And so the total fat will already include those other things in there. That's the total fat, but it's breaking down the types of fat are in there. So you might see like 9 grams of total fat, and 4.5 of that is saturated fat. Saturated fat is the fat that is not as heart healthy for us. We usually want to keep that a lower number. You'll see it in things like some of your fattier cuts of meat, your butter. One of the really fun debates is about coconut oil. Coconut oil is very high in saturated fat, but then people get into this, well, it's plant-based, it's a medium chain fatty acid, but the research does show that it does impact cholesterol levels, but because it's medium chained, it might support your healthy cholesterol levels as well. So there's like this big debate about coconut oil. But anyways, keeping saturated fat low would be great. It's got cholesterol in there. Cholesterol has gone back and forth over the years in research, but the consensus basically is that dietary cholesterol doesn't impact our cholesterol levels as much as we thought it did before. You'll see sodium in there. For our athletes that are sweating a ton day in and day out in their training, I usually just say, you know, it's okay to have a little more sodium and salt because we're trying to always replenish those electrolyte losses. And then coming to the carbs, right? So total carbohydrates, you will notice, is bolded because it's going to include the fiber, the total sugars, and all of that in that total carbohydrate range. So I usually like to look at the total carbs first and foremost, especially if I'm looking at like a fueling product, just to be like, okay, how many carbs am I getting from this to help me, you know, fuel for this workout, or maybe post-workout, like, hey, I just put in a really long ride. I need to get a lot of carbs in. I'm going to look at that total carbs. Now, with fiber, when I look at fiber, it depends on kind of when I'm eating this. You know, if it's just an everyday kind of thing, fiber is really good for us. It's very good for gut health. It's good for lowering cholesterol levels. We get fiber from whole grains, fruits, vegetables, legumes, you know, beans, chickpeas, those types of things. I would typically tend to shy away from things that have a lot of like inulin or like chicory root, like that kind of fiber additive stuff. Those tend to be very gas producing. And I don't know, I'm just not personally a huge fan of them for athletes, especially if they're already kind of struggling with some GI issues, you know, especially for runners. And then total sugars you'll see on there. And then you might see a line that says how many added sugars. So if there's naturally occurring sugar in there, that'll be in that total sugars. But if they're adding something in there, like, you know, cane sugar, honey, molasses, or anything added in there, that will be in that added sugar line. You might also see sugar alcohols in there. That's kind of a newer one I've seen. Sugar alcohols don't really contribute to the total carbs. But if you're seeing a lot of sugar alcohol, I would just be a little concerned because those also can be very gas producing. If you have a ton of sugar alcohols, it can cause explosive diarrhea, and we would definitely want to avoid that. So, like, those are the things that I look for, you know, in that total carbohydrate range. And then obviously you have your protein in there. It's great to have protein post-workout and throughout your day. And then you'll see your micronutrients, your vitamins and minerals below that. So those are, I mean, and the daily value, you'll see on that side, those percentages, I tend to typically ignore them. Those are based off of like a 2000 calorie diet, which not a lot of people need an exactly, I mean, a lot of people, especially athletes, are going to need a lot more calories than that. So that's kind of my rundown of the label.
Alex, of those things on the label, mm-hmm. like nutrition is so contentious. The one thing I've never heard any debate on is everyone's like, don't eat trans fats.
Yeah.
Like protein, animals, everything else. That's the one thing. Can you tell us like, why would we not want to eat trans
fats? Yeah. Trans fats are going to come from, those partially hydrogenated oils, and they are directly related to like increasing cholesterol levels, being very unhealthy for our heart. And so they're basically at this point kind of banned from our food these days here in the US. So you're going to usually always see that as zero, but it's still on the label. But yeah, it's something hands down, we want to always keep that at zero.
The other interesting thing is the cholesterol. Like, I've heard that cholesterol can support hormones. Like, it's needed for especially testosterone in men. And there's an interesting study. It's just one study, but they had athletes eat whole eggs or white eggs in the morning. And the athletes who ate the whole eggs, there was three per day, had increases in testosterone, hand grip strength, and lower body fat percentage versus just the egg whites. But they had no difference in muscle mass. And you can get stronger without an increase in muscle mass, which is interesting. That's kind of like what we are kind of all
in, all about.
But yeah, natural ways, especially for older athletes, to raise their testosterone. If I mean, more research needed, but eggs have gone back and forth, right, over the years about healthy and unhealthy.
Yeah.
Like, it's been like,
how
pretty
many,
nuts.
Like, are eggs good? Are they bad? How many should I have a day? You know, like, the recommendations constantly change. And that's the thing about nutrition, is it's always evolving. So what we're talking about here might, you know, our advice might change, you know, in 2-3 years as new research is coming out. And I know it gets frustrating for people, but it truly is an evolution, and it's a newer science. I mean, it really is. So you have to just give us some grace in that, like, we're always continuing to learn.
I think that's why some things get like lots of attention, because they say this is the forefront in research, right? And it's like, all you got to do is eat only meat. That's the way to be healthy. And then like, and livers, right? And then there's the liver king who's on steroids showing you that I just eat liver and that's the way it happens. And it can be very convincing, right? And then you say some like mechanism that happens and you show your results. You say, I don't do steroids. This is just for meat. And you're a 16-year-old boy and you're like, hey, I want to look like that. I can just eat meat. Let's do it. I think that a lot of people get, you know, caught up in those sorts of things.
Yeah. I think an important message is don't get your nutrition advice where the only credibility they have is they look good in a bathing suit, you know, right? Like, that's my personal thought on it.
They look good or they're like really fast. It's crazy that like, just because they're fast, we can get information from them. And like, the best coaches in the world aren't fast. Like, that's just what it is. You see a basketball coach ever try to like, any basketball coach, high school, whatever, they'll never shoot a ball or do a layup. Like, because they don't know how to do it, right? Like, maybe some old NBA players, but in general.
Andy Reid probably has a hard time scoring a touchdown, you know?
Like, exactly, right? Yeah, but he's pretty good.
I think he knows
coach.
How to do it, though. You
yeah.
know?
Yeah, yeah. But in some other sports, you're like, that's the fastest local person, so I'm going to do what they say. And a lot of it is like, they just had really good genetics, and that's why they're faster than everyone else local.
And that's why sometimes they're even worse people to ask it from, because they don't know how. Right. They're just like, it just happens. Mm-hmm. Like, I just win. I don't know how.
Yeah. Well, I mean, look,
the best is when
there was a video of Taylor Nibb talking about her nutrition that she did in her recent race. And she had this whole nutrition plan and then she didn't do any of it. And they're like, she's basically relying on her genetic gifts and the fact that she's young at this point. But, you know, as you get older, you have to follow your nutrition plan if you're going to deliver on race day.
Yes.
I think what you should follow are someone or a company who has taken time and time again, people from A to B. So with Alex, you've taken, maybe it's not the best physique in the world, but taking people from a spot where they're at A and a part where they've improved over and over again, over lots of people where they've seen an improvement. And then sprinkle in some national champions in there too, who you did it and you got trainer own Alex. And that's what I think you should follow.
Alex, I want to ask, great advice, Nate, because that's the consensus, right? Like, it's just like kind of like a meta-analysis or systematic review, or it's not looking at individual cases, but it's looking at a trend and something
that over and over again,
operates on a larger scale, repeatable, all that. So it just means it increases your chances, right? And that's where we should place our bets. Alex, can you explain the interaction between, so I've heard this, like, particularly with those pursuing a low carb lifestyle or even like a keto lifestyle, that sort of thing, when they look at the amount of fiber in relation to the amount of carbohydrates and they view like, oh, well, it has this amount of fiber, therefore it cancels out that carbohydrate. I don't know if you're familiar with that whole like approach that people take with that.
Like net carbs.
Exactly. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it used to be, way back in the day that we would, how we were recommended as dietitians to calculate it is if your, gosh, now I have to remember this. I believe it was like, if it was over 5 grams of fiber, you could subtract that from the total carbs. It was, I think, how we like used to calculate the net carbs. But then as the research kind of kept looking at this, then we found like, oh, well, even if there is some fiber in there, our body is still digesting some of that and we have to count it towards carbs. So then it was like you had to take that 5 grams of it and make it 2.5 and subtract that. I mean, it was so confusing at that point. And honestly, I don't even think I know what the current recommendation is because I haven't really followed the net carb at that point. Because, you know, I work with endurance athletes and I just want them to get enough carbs, you know, I mean, because a lot of them are just not getting enough. So, yeah, that's kind of the gist on the net carbs. I mean, from the last I heard was that, even if it does have a lot of fiber, our body is still kind of breaking down some of it and getting some carbohydrates from it.
Cool. Awesome. That was good. That was like an entire, like I could see somebody writing out a blog post that would be super lengthy. You just crushed that one right there. That was great. Good
Thank
job.
Thank you.
Alex. Thank you. Yeah. Okay. Brittany, this is a great question. Again, we're talking about meal suggestions now. And by the way, if you're appreciating this, give the video a thumbs up, share the podcast with your friends. This is free content and we will continue to make it free. And we do it because we want to make people faster. So if you appreciate this, share the podcast with your friends and then sign up for Trainer Road. That's the whole reason why we do this thing, to make y'all faster and show that you can trust us to make you faster. So, okay. Brittany says, I'm relatively new to the endurance sport world, and I'm overwhelmed by all the instructions and guidance on how to manage my nutrition. I played soccer all through high school and college, and looking back, I'm a bit shocked and surprised this was never a part of our education. And Nate, you're shaking your head.
Well, yeah. Last week we talked about this, is that soccer players like don't want to drink carbohydrate drinks while it's just not part of the culture. I told my son, he's 10, this, and how that would be the benefit for him to be able to run faster than people. And he had his first Gatorade during practice.
Amazing. Like, there we go. Yeah. And that was with Dr. Kyle Pfaffenbach last week. He was talking about how he deals with like these different pro athlete teams and everything else. And he says soccer players are the absolute worst at trying to get to take in carbs. Really good episode. If you haven't listened, go check it out. But this is a really good point that Brittany brings up. And before we even get into like our question here, this is something that's pretty shocking that like, it's not, when you join like a youth sports team, oftentimes it's just teaching you how to do the thing, not how to prepare your body to do the thing, if that makes sense. Like, and like athletes, I feel like should be educated and taught, like when they're in middle school and they're in all these, they should be taught about how important it is to get sleep so that they can recover so then they can play better the next day. They should be talking about nutrition and educating themselves on like what things can help them improve their performance, right? And focusing on it in that degree, instead of just saying eat healthy because you're an athlete, because I think that's pretty hard advice to follow. But this just resonates with me. I hear this and I see my kid's son's doing baseball right now and he's done a ton of different sports and all that. And I think it's just really important.
It is tough to educate kids, but especially about like changing, you know, their eating habits. Like it's tough. So you do have to kind of come in from a perspective that resonates with them. For soccer players, for example, and I have a really good friend who's a dietitian for soccer athletes. And I've told her this story. I read it. It was right before one of the World Cups, and Rose Lavelle, I believe it was about, and she went to the University of Wisconsin for college, and she had like injury after injury in her college career. And the U.S. coach was calling, you know, her coach and said, hey, what's up with Rose? You know, I'm interested in her. And her coach totally threw her under the bus and said, she's not taking this seriously. She's not fueling well. And Rose was sitting right there and listening to this conversation because they were on speakerphone, and she was angry that she had gotten thrown under the bus. But then she headed straight to the college dietitian and turned things around, got healthier, and, you know, made the team. And that's reading that story to me, I was like, that is going to resonate with soccer players. It's not going to be their parents or their coach telling them what to eat. It's seeing that Rose Lavelle changed things around and made the U.S. team. That's going to be much more influential. And then at that point, once you have that vested interest, you can start making suggestions and then like just having that available to them. So you also have to talk with the parents and making sure that they're providing the right stuff as well. So it's complicated when it comes to fueling youth. I don't personally work with youth athletes. I get a lot of inquiries from parents, and I usually refer them out to other dietitians that are focused on, you know, high school athletes. But yeah, it's a tough age group to influence. That's for sure.
Yeah. It also, it could be a situation because I bet when I was a kid and I was going through sports, maybe my coaches were telling me all this stuff, but I just did not hear it. You know what I mean?
Yeah. It's like, it's probably true. I mean, the time we're just trying to get our kids to eat, you know, they like hardly eat a breakfast. They like skip lunch at school and then they might have, you know, a energy drink, you know, after school to get them through the last few hours of the day. You know, there's a lot of room for improvement with what they eat.
Do you have tips for that, Alex? My son, he is underweight for his age group. And he actually, even last night, he told me how he can get teased at school and he wants to eat more, but he doesn't like a lot of foods. And we're always trying to experiment and he gets full really easily. Do you have any tips on that?
Yeah. So I'm actually struggling with that with my 6-year-old and, or actually he's now 7. For me, it's like just as frequently as possible. Like we have a lot of snacks throughout the day, but then also timing it so that he doesn't have a snack too soon before dinner so that he's still hungry for dinner. And then just trying to find like high calorie foods. So sometimes I'll just make like a really high calorie like strawberry milkshake for them. If I have like leftover strawberries that need to get used up, I'm like, I'm going to blend up a smoothie and just try and get them to. At that point, it's like any calorie is a good calorie. And if I can sneak in some bonus nutrition, like strawberries and a milkshake, like that's my go-to there. Or like even adding some like avocado to something like that to add some extra fat in there. Just like I mean, I might, or like get them involved in the kitchen and say, hey, let's try some new foods, see what flavors you like. Yeah. I mean, it's tough, but and you know, I do talk with my son too about like, hey, you know, your little brother is catching up into you in weight, and when you guys wrestle, he's gonna win a lot more if you guys weigh the same. So we need to get you to eat a little bit more because those calories are energy and they're gonna help you grow. And I try and talk about food in a very positive way. So my 4-year-old, for example, he'll be eating like cottage cheese. He's like, did you know that cottage cheese has protein? And protein is really good for your muscles. I was like, oh, that's so interesting. Like, and then my husband rolls his eyes and he's like, tell me your kid's mom is a dietitian without telling me your kid's mom is a dietitian. And I was like, yeah, I talk about like the perks of what food offers us and what it can do to help our energy and our body. And oh, and my sons really like to run really fast. And so I said, hey, this protein will give you lots of muscles so that you can run really fast. And they're like, ooh, I want to run really fast. And so just helping them kind of connect the dots and that food can offer them a lot of value can be helpful.
Yeah. I know my nephew has really struggled with that, and he's a big time soccer player, like traveling team. They like travel all over the Western US to play and stuff. And he's really small, and it's been like a big challenge for him with the sport of soccer. And, you know, there's a lot of different issues that go into that, but I think that advice of getting them involved in the process of creating the food and everything else makes it a lot more fun for him. And I think that's really helpful. We're struggling with our little like 1-year-old right now because she's an entirely social eater. She'll just eat based on the people that she's with. And if she's not like, if she's with mom right now, she will not eat. It's just that simple. But if she's sitting with dad, then she is totally happy to just take her time and to eat whatever we offer her and to go through all that. But it's, yeah, man.
I've noticed a huge difference once my kid started eating school lunch every day because he's with all of his friends and they're all eating the same thing. And he's been so much more open to trying new foods now just because of his experience with school lunch. So that's been really fun to see that there's foods that I love that I make at home and he for some reason would not touch them. And then just recently he tried it. He's like, this is amazing. I go, yes, okay, he will eat this food. I can feel like I can.
It's the best.
Yeah, it's so great. Like when they start.
But it happens always for me. Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I was just gonna say it's just when you personally, you know, love food, it's nice when your kids start to get into that. And you have to be patient with kids because some just take a little while to get to that stage.
With me, the love a meal, next time, won't even taste it.
Yeah.
Like, oh,
super normal.
It looks horrible now.
It's so like frustrating.
You said it was the best thing you've ever ate last time. Yeah, and I was like, no, I don't want this. Yeah.
I would say it is particularly tough with kids, but I feel like a lot of us adults probably we have similar challenges. Maybe somebody listening to this that's an adult. So hopefully that's helpful for everybody listening to this. Brittany then says, coming from a college diet, and then she says in parentheses, read Chipotle bowls, Starbucks, and fast food way too often. I would really appreciate recipes for 3 meal suggestions for each meal of the day. And if it's not too much trouble, maybe writing them out somewhere where I can get them. So we'll write them on screen here, and then we'll also put them down in the description of this podcast. So whether you're listening on Spotify or on YouTube, you can check this out. But Alex has some suggestions for y'all for different options that you can pick.
Yeah. And I actually pulled a lot of these from our blog at alexlarsonnutrition.com, because we have quite a few that are just, you know, lists of different, like, you know, 10 protein rich lunch ideas or breakfast ideas. So I pulled a lot of these from there. So there is some actual recipes as well on there, but just like at breakfast, and breakfast is my favorite meal of the whole day. So I'm very passionate about my breakfast. But when I work with athletes, we're always trying to find ways to get more protein at breakfast, especially if it's like a post-workout meal. So Greek yogurt would be always a go-to. That's easy, something that you can put together really quickly, especially when you're trying to get out the door to go to work, putting some oats with it. And then I like to just reheat some like frozen blueberries or like fruit with that. Because, you know, you never know if you're going to have like fresh on hand. If you do, great. But if not, frozen works really well. If you like oatmeal, it's kind of more of like a wintery like comfort food. But cooking it with like a high protein milk, like I know, Jonathan, you and I both have Fairlife in our fridge. So doing a little bit higher protein milk with oatmeal. Batch cooking like a large quantity of like an egg muffin, where you're putting like veggies and eggs and meat together in like a muffin tin and cooking that up. You can freeze those really easily and then reheat in the microwave. Those would be my 3 like go-to things that I like to use at breakfast. And then lunch, doing some sort of like open-faced bagel or sandwich with like either, like for me, I love smoked salmon, or you could do like some tuna with some fruit to have some carbs on the side. Depending on if you're like training, I would do a whole bagel sandwich. Or if you're more of an off season where you're not training a whole lot, then I would do maybe a half bagel. One of my favorite, and this is like a very like convenient, quick lunch that I love, is like I'll buy the bagged salad kit. So it's pre-washed lettuce. And then adding some like quinoa or brown rice. There's this Seeds of Change. It's a brown orange bag that you get at Costco. It's a microwavable thing where you just microwave it, and it's got garlic seasonings already added to it. It's delicious. I add it to my salad kits, and then some like rotisserie chicken that I pull off, you know, a chicken maybe once a week. We try and have a rotisserie chicken just available to add to meals, and just mixing that together and having like a chicken salad with some quinoa. Love that as a lunch. Or you could do like some pita bread. If you have access to like an oven or an air fryer, you could just take pita bread, put like your favorite spaghetti or pasta sauce on it, put some toppings like leftover veggies, some like Canadian bacon, or even if you have what would be like a plant-based thing, you could put some like chickpeas on there. Have a side of Greek yogurt to boost the protein, but you'd air fry that pita bread pizza, and that's like a really quick and easy way to do like a lunch pizza. And then dinner, I've actually got an actual recipe for this. So you'd go to, it's at Skinny Taste, you type in paprika chicken stew. This is one of my favorite recipes from there. It's like, use like chicken thighs or like chicken drumsticks, but you also can use chicken breasts. I've used that. I've swapped out the veggies as well. It usually uses like onions and bell peppers, but I've used like carrots and spinach in there too. But it's so flavorful. I follow it pretty much to a T, other than swapping out maybe the veggies. And then I'll just serve it either over rice or with some potatoes. And that is very, very easy to make. Like you just kind of throw it in your like Dutch oven and let it cook and simmer for a while. And it makes your house smell amazing. So that's like the one specific recipe that I could think of for Brittany. And then since she mentioned Chipotle, you can do your own like Chipotle bowl at home. You can have rice, black beans. If you're plant-based, you can do some like tofu, any leftover like rotisserie chicken or lean meat you can add on there, some corn, bell peppers, salsa, shredded cheese, and make your own bowl at home, which is really nice because if you have multiple people in your family, they can kind of make whatever, you know, their preference is, or like a sheet pan meal where you're roasting some meat, maybe like pork loins or chicken breast with some veggies on one side. And then for your starch, you can take either like a baked potato or a sweet potato. You stab it with a fork all over and you can microwave that for a few minutes and you get yourself like a cooked like baked potato or sweet potato. So those are my three dinner ideas.
Nice. One thing that I noticed, you were like integrating different types of fish into there, like in the like the lunch thing. I don't know about Nate and Alex. I don't get enough fish. I love fish, but I just don't get enough of it because usually when I think of it, I'm like, oh yeah, okay, like I'll go and get some salmon from the store. And then whenever I see it, I'm like, oh my gosh, it's like 10 times the price of chicken. I might as well just buy the chicken, right? And yeah. I don't end up getting it. But you bring up a good point with like smoked salmon, canned tuna, even like easy, like just
you
like
do canned salmon that's
stuff.
Super high in like calcium and omega-3s. Like it's just a really nice alternative protein option if you're getting tired of chicken or turkey or you know, other things.
There's a whole TikTok, like you get on different types of TikToks, and there's a TikTok all about canned fish reviews. About all the different kind of canned fish you can get at, you know, Trader Joe's and stuff, and what's really fishy and what's not, and they're all really inexpensive. And then people eat them with crackers, you know, like a whole grain cracker, and that'd be a great way to save some money, especially for a college athlete, because you can keep those in your dorm or whatever without the refrigerator. I know what I would do. You'd buy all these fruits, you'd get so motivated, ADHD thing too. You'd buy all these things, and a week would go by, and they're all rotten. And you're like, I should have just. Why did I do this? Yeah. Anything that can store helps. Like, so frozen berries, oats, things like that. Potatoes store last a long time. The microwave potato thing is fantastic.
It's so easy.
So cheap and so easy. Yeah.
Yeah. And you can buy like baked potatoes in singles. You know what I mean? Like they have those at the store. So it's very easy to do. But yeah, I'm all about like, I mean, as a mom of three young kids right now, like I'm all about the quick and easy at this point. And when you have a busy lifestyle, like you have to find what works for you to get in the nutrition that you need.
When you buy potatoes too, like it's like $1.50. You know what I mean? I buy enough potatoes for the family and it's like really, really cheap.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a really good way to do it. And Eric, we've mentioned this before, but things like Instant Pots, pressure cookers, rice cookers, and you know, like air fryers. These are like things that like you don't want to have just a kitchen full of kitchen gadgets that you don't use.
I have an entire closet full of gadgets.
Yeah.
Me too.
But I will say the ones that I use commonly and repeatedly, and I'm going to talk about one that I really want here, and I don't know if you guys have it, but the ones that I use commonly and repeatedly, air fryer for sure. It's like so quick and easy. It's also a really fun way for your kids to cook. It's not like you're dealing with a hot oven that they have to open up, put oven mitts on and move stuff. But instead, like my son can totally put the stuff in, then put it in and just do it himself. And kids just love to be able to do the things themselves. They're people and they want to be respected as people. So it makes dinner a whole lot easier when they can be involved. That one. And then also an Instant Pot. Like you can make so much stuff with those. Like one that we've done, I think it's from the Scratch Labs cookbook, but it's like a green Thai curry, something like that. There's a really good curry recipe in there that we've made, and you just pop it all into the Instant Pot and then it's done. And it's like so easy to just toss on to whatever you have. It's good with rice. It's good with potatoes. It's good with some sort of like any various different forms of pasta. Like it's a really flexible thing. So that can be really good to do.
It might be actually you tell me the one that you want. Maybe it's
the
creamy.
I want the creamy.
Oh,
the ice cream.
I've heard about those. I kind of want one too.
Well, let me tell you all about them. So the other thing that I'm
Nate's
doing.
Nate's affiliate link below. Just joking. Yeah.
You know. Well, one thing for my son, he likes ice cream, but we're gonna switch it to protein ice cream. We've done this, and you take the Fairlife like 42. And then I'm going to add a little bit of, instead of extra milk, heavy cream, because this kid needs as many calories as he can. And the key is you put in like a tablespoon of Jell-O pudding mix. And that's what makes it like really feel creamy, because the protein doesn't have enough fat in it to really feel creamy. And then you put like vanilla in it. And then when we mix it and then we sprinkle, or you can do a mix in with like a Heath or something, like a little bit of candy on it. And then he can have it though. And he's like, Dad, can I have protein ice cream? Can I have protein ice cream? And he's getting way more, you know, 20, 30 grams for him too at 65 pounds. That's a heck of a lot of protein. And he'll eat it all up. And that's going to be, we just ordered more protein to be able to do this, but that's a really fun way.
Yeah.
And
the other one is we have an athlete right now that's using the creamy, and Mary, who's on my team, and I are both like, we need one of these. This sounds amazing.
You can dump a whole thing of like Dole pineapple into it, put a little bit of that pudding mix and freeze it, and it tastes like a Dole Whip from Disneyland. And my kids will just eat that whole thing too. That's awesome. Talk about carb heavy. Eat that on the bike, like that'd be
that's a good idea.
Well, I was gonna say the device that I also really like, this sounds kind of fancy, but it's amazing, is the sous vide. Do you guys have one of those?
Oh yeah.
Like,
yeah.
I had a stick. I didn't really use it a lot. Yeah.
Yeah.
The wand.
Yeah. As far as like cooking up fish and meats, like you can cook it to perfection basically, and you just have to sear it afterwards. So if you're someone that really struggles with like cooking meats and worrying about like either under or overcooking, a sous vide is a really nice, safe option to do that. And have your food turn out delicious and not have any like food waste. That's the big key thing I find with using one of those.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. So if you don't have any of those kitchen gadgets, you can still cook all those recipes that we just came up with. We'll put them down below for you. So then that way you can go check this out and get some good stuff to go. Christina.
One more question. Alex, for like soccer player versus cyclist, I would think that their nutrition would probably be pretty similar. Like soccer players can run 7 miles, you know, in a game, 90 minutes. Mm-hmm. Like, any thoughts on that? Would you change anything?
Not really, other than, you know, they're traveling to their game, maybe after school, is having just like on the go, like post game or pre game, you know, carbs that are easy to travel with would be the most important thing. But obviously, eating, and it depends on timing too of the day. You know, some people are, their games are in the evening. Sometimes they're midday on a weekend. Sometimes they're a tournament that's all day long. So you really have to kind of adjust based off that timing. And then that halftime is where you're trying to get some easy carbs in. So whether it's Gatorade or some sort of high carb mix, you just try and refuel so you can stay strong throughout that second half would be my go-to. But Jonathan, I'll send you an account of a soccer nutritionist that's a good friend of mine, and she's amazing. She's got great content for those that have soccer players.
Awesome.
Well, thank you.
Love it. All right. Christina says, big thank you to my favorite podcast crew. If you feel like Christina, rate it 5 stars. We'd appreciate that. It says, I gave birth to our first child last September, and returning to training has been a journey. And journey is written in all caps. I see athletes like Chelsea Sodaro win Ironman World Championships postpartum, and I simply do not know how they do that. I expected it to be difficult, but the most surprising thing has been how hard it has been to figure out nutrition. I know there are a ton of changes that went on and continue to go on with my body, and then says in parentheses, still breastfeeding. But no matter what I try, I always seem to feel flat during my workouts and starving after. But then when I try to fuel with more carbs, my stomach feels bloated and painful and leads to GI distress. I'm sure everybody has a unique experience postpartum, but do you know what is actually changing in my body that seems to not allow me to get the energy I need from carbs in order to train, and what I can do to change that? Thank you. And I know that probably you're listening to this, like cycling is like 98% dudes. So I know that a lot of you listening to this are probably like, I don't know how this relates to me. Hopefully we can glean some really, because I've felt this way before after different periods in my life where I'm like, I feel like I'm just putting this stuff in, but I'm getting nothing from it. So hopefully we can understand this from not just the postpartum perspective, but it's important to address it from there. And especially Alex, I mean, it's relevant to you.
Like, yeah, I mean, I could be Christina here. This could be me submitting this question, because I also had a child in September. So Christina and I have, you know, a 7-month-old baby right now. And it is a journey to come back to fitness after having a child. And I also don't know how Chelsea Sodaro did it, other than from what I read, she had her parents watch the baby a lot. And also she, you know, her job is to be a triathlete. So that was, you know, for her to return, she had that, she didn't have another job that she was going to as she was doing all that training. So it is a little bit different, but it is difficult. And I just want to reassure Christina that I also am trying to figure out my nutrition, and this is my third baby, in navigating breastfeeding, because I think what a lot of new moms don't realize is how sensitive your milk supply can be to exercise, to our nutrition, to our hydration. And so like you're having all of these things that you're juggling, you know, you're trying to return back to a level of fitness. You're trying to have your body start to feel normal again. You're trying to still feed your baby. Like, there's a lot going on. It's a bit of an overwhelming process mentally. So I just want Christina to know that she can reach out to me if she wants. And I feel her pain. As far as why she's feeling like bloated and that pain and GI distress, it's hard for me to like know exactly what's going on. I'd have to kind of investigate. But what I would probably say is if she's feeling flat during her workouts is I would make sure that she's fueling with plenty of carbs before she starts that workout. But if she's feeling bloating and some pain, I would maybe look to more like liquid carbs. Like I would do some sort of like sports drink or hydration mix because she's not going to have a lot of like bulky food in her stomach and it's going to get digested a lot faster and help fuel that workout. And if she's feeling starving after, that might be a sign that she just needs to up that carb intake before that workout. Or just maybe she's not eating enough throughout the day. For every ounce of breast milk that we produce, it's about 22 calories. So on average, it's like 500 to 600 plus calories a day that you're producing in breast milk. So when a lot of energy. You know, when after I had my first kid and my husband's like, "Why are you so tired? The baby's sleeping through the night." I was like, "I'm producing in milk alone, I could go for a 5-hour bike ride and it's about the equivalent of the calories that I'm using to produce, like to feed this baby." And he's like, "Oh, okay, I get that." Like just that like context for him was like, that's a lot of energy. So keep in mind that like you do have to eat more to keep up your supply and to start exercising. And for me, as I go through this from the last time with you know, this final baby, I keep in mind this quote of we can do everything. We just can't do everything all at once. Whatever that quote is, you know. So I'm like, I can do all the things, Alex, but I just have to be patient and take things one at a time. So I'll be done breastfeeding here in a few months. I can get back into exercise and feel like, you know, my workouts are going to feel a lot better at that point. So be patient, Christina. You'll get it figured out. But that would be my suggestion, is making sure that you're eating consistently throughout the day and then trying to have some more liquid carbs beforehand.
I have a thought on this too. Like I'm hearing that feeling flat, and then if trying to get in like a lot of carbs and feeling like you're bloated and everything else. I wonder how much of this too could also be tied in with hydration levels. Like it's like just when you're talking about the caloric demands of breastfeeding and then also carrying all that additional stress, like look at the amount of steps per day that a mom takes with a newly born child, like one that's walking around or getting close to that. Like you are on your feet all day, like trying to chase after the little one. You know,
work is rest. Like, I just need to like take it easy and go to work.
I always look forward to Mondays because I'm like, oh, yay, I get like my kids will go to daycare and I'm going to get a break, you know, because it is very taxing. Yeah. And hydration.
There's also
is
that hydration demand, though, that's huge because then when you're breastfeeding as well, that's also using a whole lot of liquid that you would otherwise be using to fuel your workouts and to help with all that. And chronic dehydration also is probably, I mean, if this is absolutely just me assuming, but knowing how glycogen is stored and knowing how it's stored in our bodies.
So she's like, I got to
call. Alex. But knowing how glycogen is stored, it requires water for that process. And if you're chronically dehydrated, it's really tough to be able to it's going to make it tougher for your body to be able to store that. And thusly, it's going to be harder when you're going into the workouts. And then if you're just pushing your gut full of carbs all of a sudden and you're dehydrated, then it's going to make it really tough. Like I know that somebody's listening to this and like, oh, it's really simple. It's just hydration and everything else. But when you're trying to keep another person alive, like it's easy to forget about all the other things that you have to do to take care of yourself because it's a lower priority.
It's amazing how much nutrition goes into lactation. Like it's just incredible. Like I'm very religious, especially this time around. because I feel like I'm just smarter and wiser as a mom, is like still continue to take a prenatal vitamin to like get that additional like nutrition. Calcium intake is something that's really, really important, because there's a lot of calcium that goes into producing milk. And if you're already starting to exercise, you could be at risk for like a stress fracture. So just making sure that you're getting, you know, the recommended calcium amount throughout the day through your diet, I think is really important. And Mary, who she's a dietitian on my team, she's got two girls, and she's a very strong marathon runner. And after she had, I think her second child, she had a DEXA scan done, and right as she was finishing breastfeeding, and her bone density was like borderline osteopenia, and she was horrified. Wow. So that's something also, you know, as you return back to fitness, is maybe going to get a DEXA scan and checking your bone density and health, to making sure that you're not going to be at risk for having any injuries. Because having a stress fracture and a young child is a nightmare at that point.
Yeah. I've found there are periods of time where, because of the way that I'm taking in my carbohydrates at different points, it's not optimal for me to then be able to process those carbohydrates. The one I already mentioned was with hydration. The second one I'd also mention is that if I'm taking in a huge amount of fiber in my diet all the time, it does seem to slow digestion. It makes it tougher for me to be able to take in the nutritional value and just be ready to perform. And it does make it so that I can have a more bloated gut and everything else. Like, fiber is really good and it's very healthy. But at the same time, it's not something where you can just like, if you take it in all the time, you do have to understand that it's probably going to affect how quickly you can process stuff. So I think that that's like a key thing to keep to like measure. And really, I'm not saying measure this like numerically, but just be like, all right, how often am I taking in liquid, and how often am I taking in all the electrolytes that I need to be taking in? And then how am I taking in my carbohydrates? If you're just taking your carbohydrates through like simple sugars and everything else, you're going to have a lot of swings. It's going to be tough to be able to do that. If you're taking it through more complex, it's going to be more sustainable. Just make sure that you're spacing it out from your rides. And if you are going to have a lot of fiber, maybe not pre-ride is the best time to do it, but post-ride is probably going to be a better time to get all that in. And when I've like gotten those things kind of work, like the positive and the negative switched and those sort of things mixed around, I have gone through these periods where I'm just like, I don't know what's going on, but I don't seem like I'm responding. And that's commonly, sleep's an entirely different thing though too, which is likely compromised here and probably affecting all this too. It's just really hard being a new mom, you know, so hard.
New parents too. I should
say. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, new parent in general. Okay, this last question. I'm curious to hear your thoughts on this one in particular, Nate, because at one point, Nate consumed more carbs than any athlete that I know. Like, you were like Keegan level with your carbs. And because you were training a lot, carrying a high amount of training volume and doing everything else. And these days, you're not carrying a high training volume. Instead, you're doing like strength training more often. So Ronaldo says, as I've started training over the past year, I've shifted my diet from a low carb approach to a periodized carb approach. But after upping my training to 3 training sessions for each discipline each week, I assume they're a triathlete by saying that, I was feeling like I was hitting a wall in session and felt progressively worse every day. It really started to affect other aspects of my life, with my partner noting how grumpy I was, and the world just generally seemed so irritating. It got out of hand, like that quote in The Office Space, every day you see me is, that's on the worst day of my life. that's a funny section of that movie. That's really good. Hopefully we can put that up on screen during the podcast on YouTube and not get taken down for copyright. So I recently decided to let go of the carb approach and have carbs with every meal. And what do you know? I feel great in workouts and the world is a happier and more beautiful place. But this brings me to my question. I'm not a super athlete, and while I am training a lot right now, I don't anticipate I'll be like this every day of the year. After my goal race this summer, I'll likely just recreationally run or ride, but I won't be training regularly. I guess my question is, where do we draw the line with high carb intake? I don't want to overeat them and cause metabolic dysfunction. There's an assumption baked in there in the end into that question, I guess. But Alex, what are your thoughts on this one? Then we'll go into
it. I think it's really important to have that periodized approach. I like that he shifted to that. Because it's not, again, it comes back to like carbs aren't good or bad, but they are, they're there as a fuel source for us. So when we're putting out all of that training and effort, we need to have that energy available to us. And so we're going to require a high carb intake. Whereas when you're shifting more to an off season and you're going to be just doing things recreationally, you can pull back on your carb intake to align with that. I think that's where I think people struggle with that, because especially if you have a really long training season, if you're training for something that's, you know, 9-10 months long of training, you really get into a habit of loading on the carbs onto your plate at a meal, eating really frequently throughout the day. So when you go into shift into that off season, it's not just like a flip of the switch in terms of like making that change. You have to be very intentional and mindful of like, okay, yeah, how am I going to adjust my portions? How am I going to change the food choices that I'm making to more align with this new season of the year and how I'm training?
Is this relatable to you? Like, how has your diet changed, Nate? Like, when you were training a ton to now?
I want to highlight something on the end. It's like, we draw a line with high carb intake. I don't want to overeat and then cause metabolic dysfunction. And I think you may be talking about metabolic syndrome. And those are the five criteria are obesity, high blood pressure, high blood triglycerides, low levels of HDL cholesterol, and insulin resistance. And if you're training and you're an athlete and you probably have low blood pressure, you're probably not obese, you probably have really good cholesterol, and you're probably not insulin resistant too with all of those things. And you're continuing to train, like we talked about before, if you're not doing a 4-hour ride, you don't need 4 hours of carbs, like the amount of extra calories, you can reduce that, but you don't need to go no carb because you're suddenly not training as hard as you did before. And so I've switched to weight training and I've been gaining weight. I'm like 215 now, but with lower body fat than cycling. I know.
You were 170, right?
No, I was 179, 180. 180 was the lowest. So
okay, yeah.
35 Jeez. Pounds. I know. I'm a lot bigger. You haven't seen me lately.
Yeah. Different.
But it's the same thing. Like, you go into the gym and you eat low carb and it's so hard to finish the workout. And your workout's probably, I have the same experience, maybe half as good. You can't do as many sets. You're not as intense. And intensity is really, really important going to failure and weight training. My girlfriend yesterday, she was at the gym and she was doing, you know, she just focuses on one muscle the whole time, but she couldn't do the normal stuff, the normal weight. And I'm like, what'd you have for breakfast? And she was like, I had an egg or something like that. And she usually has she had a bagel, but she didn't actually eat it. So we kind of stepped back and she had not many carbs before going in. And also, you eat a lot of carbs, you get a pump, you get some, you have water in your body and some electrolytes and carbs. It's just motivating. Cause when I take a picture of myself with a pump, I look ridiculous, like a whole nother person. And it's so motivating though. It's like, it feels really cool to see that. And it's not the normal every day. You can go on TikTok, look at like pump versus not every day. And you see guys be good. Like, this is me with a pump. This is me every day. And it looks like two different people, one on like drugs, another just a regular person walking around. But I like that. It's like a good, after the workout, it's a good motivation to see it. And I'm pretty much doing the exact same diet as cycling. Just less overall calories compared to cycling.
That's interesting.
Like, yeah. Fruits, vegetables, whole grains, some fat, but not a ton of fat. And then protein, maybe protein a little bit higher. I mean, for about one gram of protein per gram of or pound of body weight, which is about 2.2 kilogram.
Grams per kilogram.
2.2 grams per kilogram. Yeah. Which is like kind of the upper limit. And other than that, it's that same mix, but just less overall carbs because I'm not doing bigger rides. And when I am riding the bike, I do up the carbs then. And I still do a sports drink and stuff like that. It's the recovery. Like, if I don't eat well, the same exact thing happens in weight training that happened to me in cycling. If I don't eat well, I can't train 2 days in a row. Mm-hmm. Or that third day, I still feel bad. I don't perform as well at work. I have brain fog. Another thing that I have to watch out for in weight training is I've stopped like the really heavy compound movements like deadlifts and squats because there's that neuromuscular fatigue that happens. I think we've seen this before when we were sprint where I am just so much more cooked and I am pretty strong. I can like deadlift over 400 pounds, but I don't do it like all the time because it just, the recovery is too hard. Yeah.
Yeah. It's just like if you sprint every day, that sort of thing, like it's going to make everything so depressed in terms of your abilities to express your the fitness that you do have is just going to be so tough. Yeah. This is interesting because for me, I feel like a lot of the time when I'm in the middle of like, and training's going really well, I'm not having life interruptions into training and I'm doing a lot. I feel like the eating part becomes a job. It's like, it's pretty tough to be able to get in what I need to do. And I do have to actually make like non-emotional decisions about food, you know, in the sense that like my emotion very much is driving me to just be like, no, don't eat, don't eat, don't eat. But at the same time, I have to look at it and I have to be like, well, actually I do need to eat. Because what,
yeah,
sorry, go ahead.
Jonathan, I know it's been in your head. It's been both of our heads for forever, right? Probably every cyclist. Think of a time where you were the fastest. Did you eat a ton?
Oh yeah.
And
absolutely.
Has it ever been bad for you? You ate so much where you got slower?
No, it hasn't.
Ever.
And right? I that might change if like what I was eating was totally different, right? If I was just downing sleeves of Oreos nonstop and that's all I was eating, I doubt I would have the energy that to be then be able to perform. I don't know, but I think that probably does matter, but yeah.
It's calorically dense food too. John eats a pretty healthy food, well-balanced diet where eating a ton of that stuff can be tough. And if you stuffed yourself with Oreos or ice cream, then you might get into a big calorie surplus. But John, you train so much that, and I swear, John, that extra food, just like me doing extra sets at the gym. Yeah. You probably just do that extra like interval, that extra like time up the hill, that extra 20 minutes, and it just turns into fitness into your body rather than like being stuck on you. And or turns into watts the next workout, which is it's so tough for us to do, especially when you eat. Alex, you probably get this to your athletes all the time. I have huge swings now because I have more muscle mass in my glycogen and my body weight. I can have like literally a 5 or 6 pound swing in a day versus like morning versus night. And then I'll go to sleep, you know, based on what I eat. And it is so scary when you first eat carbs and you see that scale go up 2 or 3 pounds in a day. And you're like, they told me that it was going to make me fatter, and it is. And you look in the mirror, the body dysmorphia in me is crazy too. That is such a real thing. I look in the mirror, I'm like, I'm the same size as before. And I try on a shirt I used to have or pants, they don't fit. Like I can't physically put them on. I should keep those shirts. Because in the mirror though, I think I look the same. And I think that happens to us cyclists too, where we eat something and we're like, oh, I'm fatter. What is this? Like my belly's a little bit bigger than I did before. It is not, but it's in our brain that it happens. I did not experience body dysmorphia as much as when I am lifting weights. It's crazy.
Well, this is interesting, Ronaldo, because like, and the reason I'm sharing this, it starts to feel like a job and I'm like, oh, it's really tough, but it's not just my cycling that gets better. It's all the other aspects of my life. Even though I'm training more, everything else gets better too. Like my ability to focus and knock stuff out at work is up. My ability to be able to just like communicate calmly and emotionally with my family when, you know, toddlers screaming and throwing stuff, that sort of thing, it goes up. And this is what I'm talking about. Like Ronaldo, I know that like there's this tendency to want to be like, I need to run it to the stops, like kind of like just run it, just be sufficient. But the thing is, I think that if we are just fueling the work on the bike instead of looking at the rest of our life as something that we need to fuel too, and when the work on the bike drops down and we drop down that nutrition as well, like sure, I you know, within reason here, there's probably limits to this, but I think that we compromise the rest of our life too. So I know, Ronaldo, you're not planning on being this like super athlete that's training for 3 disciplines, 2 times each in each discipline every week, doing all that. And you're looking forward to maybe whenever that drops off to changing up the nutrition, but take note of how it affects the other aspects of your life too, because you might very well just notice you perform better in life when you have more nutrition on board coming in like this.
You have to also think
a lot of athletes tend to undernourish.
So you have to also think of the fact of like when you're training a lot, you're also taking up a huge amount of your day. And you might be missing out on a meal because you're out training. And so you have to make up for that nutrition elsewhere in different parts of the day. Versus like in your off season where you're just putting in, you know, 45-minute hour workout here or there, you're having more time in the day to like structure in your meals and snacks a little bit easier. And something that I have our athletes do when they shift into the off season is we might still keep a higher carb rate around their workouts, but then we don't have as many carbs the rest of the day because they just didn't do that long of or hard of a workout that they need to have that additional nutrition to help them recover. So that might be something too that we'd look at. So I think when you're looking at your periodizing your training is breaking it up into different you know, ranges. Like, here's high volume training versus maybe a medium versus like just a low maintenance, you know, fitness, and kind of figuring out your nutrition that way can help provide some context, and you kind of just shift into different seasons with how you eat.
Yeah. And as always, it's super important to keep in mind like the caloric demand that you have from training, and how, if you are like a high FTP athlete, it's just crazy how many, you know, how many calories. Like I'm right now at 293 for my FTP, and at 293, if I go and do an endurance ride, that's going to be like 720 to 800 calories that in an hour that are like gone. And that's an entire meal, right? Like that quick in terms of just calories themselves that I've burned. So,
and then the amount of,
if I'm doing that ride during lunch and I've missed a meal,
yeah.
then it's even tougher.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's like double, you know, the meals that you need to replace after that. It's wild. So how many hours a week are you training right now?
Averaging right now, 7.25 okay. is what I've averaged over the past 6 weeks.
Okay. He knows.
Yeah. I was just reviewing this all last night. So yeah. yeah. And the thing, yeah, it's, so Ronaldo and anybody that's listening to this, you might not need to consume as many calories if you're burning a lot of calories with your training and that sort of, like Nate said, it's dropped down, but maybe like periodizing the carbs, like just when you do it, if you do choose to like drop back on carbs, just take note of not just like the performance on the bike. I mean, obviously if we're doing less of that, that will be there, but take note of the performance in other aspects of your life. Cause I feel like it's really crucial to make sure that if you do that, then suddenly you're like, man, why is life so hard?
I always find sleep too. If you're not sleeping well, sometimes that's a good indicator that you're underfueled.
Yes. That's so true. Yeah. Well, Alex, thanks so much for joining us. Awesome to have you. If you want to find out more about Alex, you can go find her on Instagram, Alex Larson Nutrition. We'll link down below. You can also check out her. Alex, by the way, we aren't paying Alex to do this. We just really appreciate it. And we are happy to recommend, if you want nutrition and guidance and anything else like that, you can sign up from a registered dietitian with Alex Larson Nutrition. So you can check that out. It'd be really helpful for athletes. And if you're listening to this and you haven't signed up for Trainer Road yet, I just want to, we have an exciting announcement coming soon for athletes that train outside. It's going to be good stuff. And then we also, Nate's eyebrows raising. he probably doesn't know which one I'm talking about. We have an exciting one coming out there. Okay, good. He does. Yeah. Exciting one coming there. Red light, green light works when you don't follow a training plan, and it works when you ride outside. And this is, I swear, it could be such a game changer for all of you that are just like, I like adventure rides, I like doing that sort of stuff, to like keep the fun in the rides that you do and not get to the point where you're burned out. So when you look at that $19 a month, that's darn cheap. Or if you do a year, you know, you can just sign up for the whole year. It's $15.83 a month. Really accessible and something that would really help you get faster. So go check it out, and we'll talk to you all next week. Thanks, everybody. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye.